Think Realty Nation, it's Abhi Golhar. Welcome to the Think Realty Podcast. Have an awesome show for you today. We're talking about some pretty interesting topics. Obviously, we'll do the market update, which is coming up in about 15 or 20 seconds here after I finish this little mini intro. And we're also connecting with Rich Ford, who's the Chief Development Officer and co-founder of Roofstock. You know them. Check them out at roofstock.com. We're also talking about how you can invest from the couch and some of the platforms online where you can invest potentially your hard-earned capital to see that return. So I'll list off a few names and let me know what you think about them. And last but not least, if you think about stealing from a barn, if you think about looting from a barn, if you want to be a thief and if you want to steal from a barn, what's the first thing that you think of? And I guarantee you it's probably not going to be this. Today's podcast is brought to you by Renters Warehouse, one of the largest, fastest-growing, and highest-reviewed property management companies in America. You want to check them out? Go to RentersWarehouse.com. All right. So in an earlier show, we talked about how there were some cities where home prices were 50% above the pre-recession peaks. Here are a couple of cities. That where the median home prices in these 49 out of 123 metro areas that were analyzed that are still below pre-recession peaks. The first is York Hanover, Pennsylvania, 56% below the pre-recession peak. Trenton, New Jersey, about 35% below. Atlantic City, New Jersey, 32% below. New Haven, Connecticut, 22% below. So what does this really mean in terms of the overall context of investing? Well, for me, it means I should be paying a little more attention to some of these cities. Some of these cities that may be approaching that peak a little bit, and should I be concerned if they exceed that peak? Well, it depends on the supply and demand of the area. It depends on the local economics as well and what's going on locally. There's no national real estate market. It's only hyper-local. I live in Atlanta, and many of you listening, some of you live in Atlanta too, and you know that the Buckhead area is very different than Kirkwood, which is very different than Old Fourth Ward, which is very different than the West End. So looking at these cities where you still have areas, you still have home prices that are below pre-recession peaks, I think they're good data points to pay attention to. But you know what? Focus in on some of these areas, see if it's a danger zone. That's a movie reference. Danger zone! And if you feel like it's in a danger zone, then don't apply, right? Like, don't invest in the area. But if you still feel there's good value, then be smart about it. Connect with your local real estate agents and realtors, wholesalers, brokers, developers, agents, whomever, and get a really good understanding of the lay of the land so you can be ahead of any type of bad market scenario that could occur. All right, let's jump right to it. My guest today is Rich Ford, who's the co-founder and CDO, the Chief Development Officer of Roofstock. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on. Happy to be here.
All righty. So tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do. I Googled you, so I know enough about you. I do all my online stalking like the night before. So for our viewers and our listeners that don't know who you are, give us a little background.
Yeah, sure. So I am a retired investment banker, I guess would be the place to start. I spent 20 years focusing on real estate investment banking. Managed to get involved in the single family rental sector from that angle. I was one of the early folks that saw it as an interesting space, particularly after all of the other real estate sectors had recovered. And there was a lot of institutional capital lining up alongside technology to participate in the sector and turn it into an asset class that is now more than a mom and pop type investment. And so managed to hook up with Gary and Gregor, my co-founders here, and launch Roofstock about 3.5, pushing almost coming up on 4 years ago, where we raised some venture capital funding to help democratize the space and bring technology and liquidity and reduce transaction costs to the sector, which was something that we all saw was hugely needed.
So in terms of the opportunity that Roofstock saw, I mean, obviously the single-family rental space is one where you don't have a lot of, well, previously you didn't have a whole lot of institutional play, right? You have all these folks, and it's still primarily owned by your mom and pop. Institutional capital and the funds, I mean, they represent maybe it's like two or three, maybe touching 3 percentage points of the total number of single-family homes that are owned across the United States. And BlackRock and Invitation Homes is the largest hedge fund, I suppose, that owns the largest number of homes under management for a hedge fund. And this is your non-mom-and-pop. Okay, so your hedge fund type of model, Invitation Homes is still the largest. And correct me if I'm wrong on that one, Rich, but I think Invitation Homes still, I think they're like 35 or 40,000 homes under management, something like that. It's kind of crazy.
Actually, it's about 82,000. They did a merger with Colony, and
Yeah,
it was backed originally by Blackstone. I know there was always the rocks and the stones and the rivers and the colors, but by Blackstone,
right.
And it is now a publicly traded company.
Yes.
You know, along with another big one is American Homes for Rent. But you're exactly right. It's about 2 to 3%. If you add up all of the institutional capital, maybe you get to about 400,000 homes, which is a lot of homes, but compared to the overall size of the industry, which is closer to 16 million homes,
Yeah.
it's very small. It's
It's
it's a little less than 3%. I think it's going to continue to grow. You know, we've seen that in all the other real estate asset classes over time. Once
Yeah.
institutional capital finds its way in it maybe morphs from private equity to public equity to pension funds and back to public, but you know, it generally never shrinks. So I think we'll continue to see more and more institutional capital come into the space.
What's the future of the SFR world for institutional? Do you think it's going to be continuous buying? Because I'm still seeing a lot of activity here in Atlanta, and Atlanta's a primary market. There are a lot of funds that have moved away from primary markets. They've gone to secondary markets. You take a look at like Savannah, Macon, Georgia, Noonan, Georgia, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Greenville, South Carolina. What's the future? Are funds still going to play in the primary markets, assuming that the prices make sense? Will they be focusing more on secondary, tertiary markets? What's the overall gut feel?
Yeah, there's definitely, there's a lot of capital that first came in just chasing the opportunity. And I think what's really transpired over the last couple of years in particular is the different institutions have now sort of picked their spots. I also think there is real economies of scale. And so you've got certain of the large institutions, you know, that are concentrated in several core cities and making sure they've got enough properties and mass to really be getting operational efficiencies out of it. But, you know, there are other groups and other funds, you know, that have different strategies. There's some that are more focused on a core workforce housing component and chasing yield, seeing a lot of capital coming into the Midwest currently. You know, one of the things people go to Roofstock and they see, you know, the fractional homes now and the individual homes that we trade on our site, but we have a very big business in working with the portfolios of all these large institutions. And so we've been able to see firsthand how certain groups have evolved. They've exited a market, or they will invest in or exit a certain rent price point, shaping their story for their investors. And we've been fortunate to be in a spot to help them create liquidity. We have a unique advantage of being able to sell portfolios to other groups in bulk, but also to be able to break them down and sell them individually to investors, whether those are institutional or retail investors. So we get to see a lot of that firsthand.
Got it. What do you think about some of the statistics that I mentioned as we're opening up the show? You've got prices in Hartford, Connecticut, Philadelphia, Chicago, Miami, DC, still below some of their pre-recession peaks. Are these cities that you would recommend just because they are, just because the home values there are below pre-recession peaks? Does it mean that, hey, let's go ahead and dive in head first and jump into this market? Or is there a little bit of caution that an investor should use before entering these markets?
It's a really good question. Maybe a bit of a long-winded answer because it's fairly complex. I actually was just with a client that has a big portfolio in New Jersey. You
Yeah.
know, it's one of those cities that you know, still has a lot of NPLs and REOs being worked through. So, you know, it didn't sort of rebound as quickly as a Phoenix, for example. You know, it is interesting. One of the things that I've, you know, am talking a lot about these days is that I don't believe the single family rental sector is this static sector anymore. It's fairly dynamic. If you look at a lot of the homes that were purchased post the financial crisis, you know, they were at such discounts, and the rents had stayed, you know, very moderate and flat over that period, that there was really good entry points. And so, for example, you know, our headquarters is based in the Bay Area. And, you know, if you picked a city like Antioch or Pittsburgh, you know, there were people buying homes for $180,000 with $1,600 rents. And that worked, you know, really well. Now what's happened is those rents have definitely gone up. Maybe they're $1,900 or $2,000. But some of those homes have doubled back in value, back to, you know, levels that, where they were at. And consequently, you know, they could still be great investments, but the yield is a lot different. And so some of those homes may actually revert back to owner occupants, which doesn't mean it's a bad investment. It's just that's a separate exit. On the flip side, you know, we're going to have about 1.2 million households, you know, formed each year. A lot of those are going to be looking for housing, including single family rental housing. And there's going to be a lot of product that's going to be needed. The home builders are building some. There's some build to rent, but that doesn't work in a lot of markets. And so, you know, to get back to your question a little bit, you know, it is complex. It sort of depends on your risk reward profile. There's plenty good opportunities to invest in markets where there's going to be long-term rental growth that will continue to pace. And those may be safer, you know, type investments. The home price is probably not going to, you know, gyrate too much. Mm-hmm. There's other places where you can make a bet on home price appreciation and, you know, play in that upside. And it really, it's market by market, but even within the markets, there's different rent bands that you can play in. I think there are some good opportunities in some of those markets you said specifically. We actually don't have a lot of institutional capital in most of those markets. So that could be an interesting play, you know, for some retail investors.
Yeah, you take a look at a city like Miami. I mean, I'll pick on Miami for a second, right? It's a city where you've got all these new places being developed. You had Brickell City Center. So when South Beach was the hottest thing, everybody moved from the city Miami to South Beach. And then you have Brickell City Center. And Brickell City Center, it's like all predatory, right? So Brickell City Center took all the residents from South Beach and moved them to Brickell City Center. And so there's all the stuff that's going on. And it would make sense. Well, like if I'm institutional, I'm not going to peg my, you know, I'm not going to peg my bet in Miami. You know, it's great. I don't mind a nice holiday in Miami for a weekend with a couple of drinks by, you know, beachside with my wife. That sounds great, you know. But I don't think for me, I'd place my money there. It's high in tourism, and slightly a little bit of a challenge. Chicago, right, having some challenges there. Philadelphia, actually a lot of NPLs, like you said, coming out of Philadelphia that I'm seeing across my desk as well. So that's kind of interesting too. You mentioned build to rent. And that to me is a very interesting world. That's a very interesting world to be a part of, because especially now where you have the cost of materials all-time high, cost of labor all-time high. And if you live in Atlanta, the time to get permitting, and that can be a little difficult. That can be a little longer. Your carrying costs, of course, factor into that as well. Is that why B2R, just your build-to-rent product, isn't as popular right now in some of these primary markets?
Yeah, I mean, there are some developments going on in Atlanta, but the numbers really have to pencil. I think one of the reasons that investors like build to rent is because even though the yields may be a little lower on the front end, you know, it is a new product. So they're expecting that the repair and maintenance and capital expenditures on those homes will be less. So they'll have a better margin. And over time, as rents, you know, grow, et cetera, they're going to be able to have improved yields. And, you know, obviously we have to wait a little bit for that to play out. We do sell some build to rent on our site. We put some of them into our Roofstock One product. It just doesn't work in every market. There's just certain markets where, as you said, all of those costs are just prohibitive. And it's better to buy an existing property and fix it up, and you'll get a lot better yield that way. But there's definitely some big players, American Homes for Rent, big in that sector, making some big bets in that. And I think there's, you know, if you pick your spots, there's some very good investment opportunities there. It just doesn't work in every city.
Yeah, you definitely have to be smart about the market that you're picking for that too. You can't think about going into San Francisco and saying, hey, I'm going to do a build-to-rent product here. That's just, I think, probably a really dumb idea. And you can second that if you want.
5 years later, yeah.
Right. And we just talked about solar panels, the new regulation there in the state of California. I mean, that could be a little bit of a cost prohibitive nature as well for new construction too. So that's a little bit of a challenge. Question for you. I've been doing a lot of reading with renting, with the single family rental world specifically. And let's say that we've got a downward market. We've been doing really well over the last decade, and roughly about 11 years, the second longest bull run so far, I think, in the history of the United States. And it's not that every single year rent will continue to go up. There are concerns that a lot of real estate investors are having, specifically from a buy and hold perspective, that, hey, geez, if I get in right now and I'm paying a premium, let's say I'm working with a turnkey provider, and they sell me a house generally where 4 years ago I would have paid $60,000, but I'm paying $90,000 for the same house. Okay, makes sense, right? Free market, but I'm all in at 90. And I'm going to rent this property for $900 a month. What if we see a little bit of a downward trend in the market, people start losing their jobs, all of a sudden it's not like that rental number, the $900, maybe the $800 or $1,000 a month, it's not like that can be sustained. So as a rental property owner, you're now on the hook for making that mortgage payment, and let's say you have to modify your tenant's rental amount downward a little bit, that cuts into cash flow. How do you kind of work that angle? What should I be aware of as a ma and pa investor, say somebody listening, somebody watching, and somebody that has a portfolio, you're adding more, but you want to know, what do I do in that case scenario?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I'm a lot less worried about the rent having a downward swing than the gyration of the home price. You know, what we saw post the financial crisis was that home prices dropped like crazy, but rents were steady. They, you know, they're people, it's the, you know, people need somewhere to live. Yeah. It, you know, it's a spot where it's been really consistent. And if you actually compare it to multifamily, where I do think you know, it's also been fairly steady, but you have, like we talked about earlier, almost, you know, most of this industry is mom and pops, and we haven't had this, even though rent has been growing, there is a little bit of concern of pushing rents too hard by most folks. They do not want vacancy. So they don't want to push this to a point where, you know, a tenant would leave prematurely. There's big intern costs that can be associated with that. And so what I've sort of seen in this industry is a lot of the portfolios we're selling individual properties, you know, generally if the market has had some rent growth, some of that's been captured, but a lot isn't there. And it's, you know, it's a little bit hard to necessarily say you're going to get all the way there because the market doesn't move in lockstep. This isn't like, you know, an area where you've got three big companies all moving rents at the same time. So what we've really seen is that, you know, the rent is, it doesn't really spike as quick as it can, or the market could potentially dictate. But we haven't really seen any big drops either. So I think the more important thing to think about from the mom and pop's perspective, you know, is on the actual home price. And so, and the financing. So I think where I could see people getting caught is if they put short-term financing on a home and then the price of the home drops and they need to refinance that home in that period,
bingo.
That is the thing to be aware of. Yeah.
Bingo. I agree with you on the financing piece, right? Like if you're going to put, like you said, short-term 3-5 year debt on it, that's going to be an issue. You really need to be going 15 years, 30 years and get some fixed rates. The challenge, though, that I have with the home prices is, like, if I'm buying rental properties, I should be buying for the long term, right? Like, I should be buying for 15 or 20 years. And in my mind, as a long-term real estate investor, home like, the appreciation, I don't really care, right? Like, my assumption is that the appreciation rate is going to be zero. I'm really concerned about the economics and the operating condition of that property because at that point, it is income producing. So I want to know, A, is it making money? B, am I comparable to the other properties in the area? And C, what type of tenants am I attracting that will pay that rent so I don't have to run after them? I don't have to turn the property, evictions, deal with all that. And of course, you know, I got the property manager who also needs to be paid. So I agree with about the financing piece. And I think that's a really good point. You have to make sure your financing is in the right order. Let's talk about Roofstock One real quick, and then we got to wrap it up here. Roofstock One is a relatively new initiative that was launched by Roofstock. It's your latest fund. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. And it actually gets at the comment you just made. I mean, you know, there's two things that could help with that variability. One is having a diverse portfolio of homes. that, you know, it will average out. And then the other one is having some more certainty around the cash flow. And, you know, we have lots of people that come to our site and buy homes, and they choose one of our property managers that, you know, that we vetted in each one of the markets. They choose their financing, they choose their insurance, and they're good to go. But we have a large contingent of people that, you know, want something that is more concrete and doesn't have as much variability associated with it and not as many decisions. You know, as you can expect, even though you could have something professionally managed, you're going to get called if you should push the rent or not. So what we ended up, or a turn cost, you do a big turn and try to get more rent, or a light turn. So what we
sounds like a total headache to me, right? Like, I mean, I'm growing gray fast because I have to deal with all this stuff, right? Like, Just for Men is like a number one client of mine. Like, I'm their number one client, I should say, probably.
I know this sector pretty well, and I bought a rental property in Boca Raton, and I was guilty of this where. You know, at first I wasn't sure what type of turn to do, and I dragged my feet, and the property stayed vacant for a while. Then we put the rent up too high, and I wouldn't reduce it. And I really just wanted somebody to look after it and just tell me what to do, even though, you know, I have some decent insights into the sector. But, you know, so what the Roofstock One product has done is basically it's packaged all of this together. So we own a property management company ourselves as well. And, you know, we put the property management together with the financing, together with the insurance. And we pay a quarterly dividend. We put a reserve up front. We take a consistent reserve off of the property to fund any CapEx or R&M. No one's going to ever come out of pocket. We've got a reserve system set up and an intercompany loan. We lever it pretty moderately.
Yeah.
And it's also put into a structure where you're actually buying the equity in the house. So the title technically sits with us. So that means there's no liability associated with the equity investor. And the financing is not even in the equity investor's name.
Yep.
So you get all of the cash flow associated with it and the upside when you exit, but you don't have to worry about it. It can truly just sit there.
That sounds great. I mean, when I think about that, and you said R&M, and for folks that don't know what R&M means, it means repairs and maintenance. And so that's a really big item where if you are looking at if you're looking at your budget, and if you have a single family rental, if you're looking at picking one up, you want to make sure that a certain percentage of that is set aside for repairs and maintenance. Otherwise, you'll be playing this game of cash flow juggling, and that's never fun to play, especially if you have five properties and you have some specific long-term objectives. The Roofstock One product actually is a really smart idea if you don't want any operational risk, right? But what Rich is saying, you get the upside. You get that cash flow, and it can be a really positive play, especially like you're an entrepreneur, you're a business owner. You don't want to have to deal with this stuff, right? Taking calls from property managers and saying, okay, you got to do this check mark or that check mark. I don't even like doing that. You know, like I've got radio to do, and then we got to do like the, you know, like the production of this thing. And so this is fun. This is a lot more fun to me than like getting a call from a property manager, right, Rich? I mean, that's why you do the show with me too.
Absolutely, this is fun. Yeah. I, you know, the other thing I should add is that we've now fractionalized Roofstock One as well. So
awesome.
Now you can own a tenth of a home, and you know that really does help with that diversification point, because you know for a lot of people it's you're still investing in one property, and it's a fair amount of capital to put into one property.
Yep.
This now allows you to own a tenth of this home, a tenth of that home, you know, two tenths of you know of another home. And, you know, we're pretty excited about that evolution and this fairly new product for us.
Making waves. Rich, we got to end it, but thank you so much for jumping on with me. I appreciate it. What's the best way if I want to learn more about Roofstock or Roofstock One product? Where should I go and how do I get in touch with you?
Yeah, go to our site, you know, roofstock.com. And I'm happy to give out my email as well. I can't always get to everything on the same day, but I do try to get to everything, and it's rich@roofstock.com.
That's an awesome email. I like it. rich@roofstock.com. All right, Think Realty Nation, we've got a couple more segments for you. One, we're talking about in how to invest from the couch, some of the seven online platforms that you can check out, and you know, you can tell me whether or not it makes sense or not. So that's coming up in just a second, followed by that number one thing. That number one thing that if you were to find a barn somewhere, what would you steal? And I might surprise you with the answer. We'll be right back. Z- This next segment is brought to you by Narada Real Estate Investments, your premier source for cash flow investment property. Visit them at www.turnkeyrealestateinvestments.com. So I like to sit on my couch. In fact, I'm sitting on one right now as we're filming this. And as you're listening, you can imagine me as sitting on a couch. And there are a couple different ways you can actually invest from your couch. There's a recent article that we put out on thinkrealty.com where it talks about the 7 real estate crowdfunding platforms and how you can invest from your couch. Let's take a look at them, shall we? Number one, actually, no particular order, but I'll just list them out, number 1 through 10. This is not my ranking of them. This is just a list. So maybe bullet point number 1. How about that? The Real Crowd. Number 2, Arbor Crowd. Number 3, Ground Floor. Ground Floor is headquartered here in Atlanta, Georgia. Number 4, Crowd Street. Number 5, Pierce Street. Number 6, Small Change. And of course, number 7, Realty Mogul. So we'll go ahead and talk about Real Crowd for just a second. They have a minimum investment of about $25,000. And Real Cloud believes that, quote, commercial real estate offers benefits to his investors that no other investment class can. And what's interesting about these platforms is do your due diligence, understand which one and which ones, really, if you want to invest in a couple, fit that need for you. There are some that, like Ground Floor, you can invest in both commercial, both residential, and Real Crowd, primarily commercial. You've got Arbor Crowd. Pure Street is a peer-to-peer marketplace for high-net-worth individuals that brings lenders and investors together. So rule number one when you're looking at these platforms, are they vetted? Rule number 2, is the deal vetted? Rule number 3, most importantly, the third rule, please vet your operator. You don't want to invest in somebody that you don't know anything about, okay? So those are the platforms. Check them out. If you have any questions about them or want any intros, let me know. You can find me anywhere online at Abhi Golhar, or you can get in touch with me at thinkrealty.com. So have you ever thought about stealing something from a barn? Remember I asked you that question a little earlier? Yeah, that's right. And you're probably thinking, okay, maybe it has an old Mustang. That's what I think. I think old barn, middle America, somewhere in like Kansas. I think about a old 1967 fastback Mustang that nobody has touched since the day it rolled off the lot. Well, it might be shocking that battered old wood planks this is what's being stolen the most. I don't understand that, right? Like, I would be looking for valuable things. Apparently, old wood planks are the most valuable things in some of these barns. Quote, this is an unlikely candidate for a gold rush, but they became popular about a decade ago for use on ceilings or as box beams to camouflage wiring, plumbing, or other unsightly systems. And this is coming from some of the design experts today. Mark Michaels in Winter Park, Florida says, quote, that washed tone just suggests resort living, mountain living, and relaxed living. Barn wood is also one of the most rustic and easiest of the reclaimed woods to work with. It's a more sustainable option than cutting down trees growing today. So, I don't know, maybe when you see the next barn on your drive to Kansas or whenever your next road trip is, check them out. But ask first. Don't just start chopping down an old barn and taking the wood. That's not fair. You got questions for me, get in touch. ThinkRealty.com is where I live. And that's the show today, folks. Today's podcast is brought to you by Renter's Warehouse, one of the largest, fastest growing, and highest reviewed property management companies in America. We've done a lot on the show today. We've covered a lot with Rich Ford, who is our guest, co-founder and CDO of Roofstock. If you have questions for him, you can email him at rich@roofstock.com. Got questions for me? Anywhere online. And especially ThinkRealty.com. Until next time, happy investing.